Become a part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry with an education from Trinity School of Natural Health. Trinity graduates can empower their communities through natural health principles and techniques, whether they go into practice to guide others toward their wellness goals or open a store to sell their favorite health products. Trinity grads are equipped to change lives. With 19 online programs and flexibility to fit your busy schedule, including the popular Certified Natural Health Professional, you can get the training that helps you turn your passion into a career. And here's the best part. You can earn the certification in less than a year. From herbology to naturopathy and health coaching, Trinity allows you to make a meaningful difference by helping others live healthier, happier lives. Don't wait any longer to pursue your passion for natural health. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey, everyone. This is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets, in the car while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Creature Feature, production of iHeartRadio. I'm your host of Many Parasites, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and today we're talking about animal senses. But this is a very special episode because joining me today is a science journalist for The Atlantic, Pulitzer Prize winner for his coverage of COVID-19, and author of the book An Immense World, which explores the hugely diverse way in which animals perceive the world, from the catfish that has taste receptors all over its body, to the knifefish that sees the world using electricity, from elephants who smell with their immense trunks to snakes who smell by whisking scent in with their tongues. Welcome to the show, Ed Yong.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I am so excited to have you here. I am a big fan of your articles. They are immensely helpful for me as I am researching the podcast.
Thank you. I'm delighted.
So I have read your book, An Immense World, and I absolutely love it. I think it embodies so much of what I try to talk about on the podcast, which is getting people to understand the world of animals, kind of put themselves inside of the minds of animals. But it can be very difficult sometimes to do that because animals are so different from us, so especially maybe the less charismatic, gregarious animals, it can be hard to relate to them. And it can be really hard to describe what might be the experience of animals when we're trapped in our own, you know, human brains. We can't get outside of our brains. But as a science writer, you have to try to get inside the heads of these animals. So how do you go about doing that?
Right. Well, with some difficulty, it is very challenging. And you know, I think that there's a lot of discussion around how animals think. You know, what they might feel. But you know, even on a very basic level, like how they sense, what they see, what they hear, what they're capable of seeing and hearing. There's a huge amount of variation there, and we don't. We often just don't really think about it. I think there's this very reflexive tendency to assume that animals are just seeing and hearing and feeling and smelling the same kinds of things that we are. And that's not true. This whole book is about why that's not true. But to sort of really grapple with why that's not true is immensely challenging. Like I can look at studies. I can see what science tells us about what kinds of things an animal can sense. But to really actually get into the head of that creature, to think about what a bat feels when it flies through the air, what an electric fish feels when it detects the ways its own electric field is warped by the objects around it, you're never going to be entirely able to do that. And so there's always going to be this chasm between what we experience and what other animals experience. And the only way to jump across that is with a feat of imagination. And I think there's something sort of beautiful about that. It's you're never going to be able to completely do it. It's always going to be a struggle. But it feels like such a worthwhile thing to struggle against and to sort of devote mental energy towards.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think it takes a lot of creativity, imagination, and compassion to try to imagine what it would be like to be one of these animals. And I think in your writing, that creativity and that compassion for animals is really infectious. So, like, for instance, I have a dog, and in your book, An Immense World, you wrote about how their sense of smell is so pivotal to their whole quality of life. Mm-hmm. My dog loves to smell the nastiest, rankest thing she can find on our walk and just huff that smell. And it's usually something horrifying, like, you know, some animal dropping with maybe some cigarette butts mixed in there. Right. And it always kind of irked me, but now I think, okay, well, for her, it's like viewing a piece of art for me, maybe. Going to an art gallery and taking it all in. She's going to a smell gallery, and for her, this piece of poop that has like cigarette butts in it is like some amazing piece of art for her to experience through smell.
Right. It's like Michelangelo's David. Right. So I feel much the same way. I have a dog. He's a corgi. His name is Typo.
Aww.
Whenever we're like on a walk or in the dog park, whenever he does that thing where he sniffs something and then he drops and like rubs his back on it, right? We have this joke that like, it's never a good thing. You know, it's not like someone has just recently spritzed like lavender on that spot, right? Like it's always going to be some poop or like something threw up or like there's a cigarette butt or something like that. But as you say, I think smell is so central to the life of a dog that those acts of exploration, even for things that we might find gross, are really important to them. You know, I've seen dog owners like yank their dogs along walks because they're sort of treated as exercise or, you know, pull their dogs away from sniffing another dog's genitals, for example. And all of those acts are just a normal part of a dog's behavior. And they're so profoundly linked to their sense of smell. A dog has an amazing sense of smell. Olfaction smell is primary for them in the way that vision is for sighted humans. And if we deprive them of chances to use their nose, I think we sort of deprive them of a very essential part of their dogness. You know, there have been studies showing that dogs are happier, like more optimistic, less anxious when they get a chance to use their noses. And I think like we benefit too. You know, when I watch Typo on a walk, like we walk around the same bit of neighborhood all the time, like streets and houses that I pass thousands of times over and that now feel boring to me. But they're not boring to him because they change all the time. The smells that he gets are constantly shifting, and he smells like, you know, now it's spring. I watch him like examine the like newly emerged plants with just this incredible delicacy. And I watch him like examining bits where other dogs have peed or pooped. and I see that as like, you know, me scrolling through my Instagram feed. You know, it's like me checking on social media. It's a deeply social activity. Like he can tell which of the neighborhood dogs have been around, probably like what their current state is, like what their health is like. Lots of stuff about their lives that kind of like autobiographical information that I have no access to. I don't even know you know, which dogs were there, but he does. And so every walk, if he's allowed to sniff, becomes like an adventure, a social occasion.
I love that. Yeah, we have a park where I take Cookie. And Cookie is not, she's like a little, some kind of spaniel chihuahua mutt. So she's not big on exercise anyways, but I'll take her to the park and she just loves the whole, the sniff experience of going. And she's very particular. And it's so interesting because, you know, I may want to go somewhere where it's nice and shady or there's some flowers, but she wants to go to just this uninteresting to me patch of dirt. But I'm sure there's some kind of calling card that's been left, some sort of interesting right. marking from another dog. And she's just investigating it for, you know, minutes. And it's really, I think, kind of once you really put yourself into that mindset of them exploring the world, it does become more interesting for you observing them, seeing that fascination in their eyes kind of light up when they find a particularly smelly patch.
Right. Like, I think all dog owners like know this feeling where you're just going for a, where you're going for a walk and the dog is like happily trotting along and then suddenly like just grinds to a halt and like flips around and starts investigating some random patch of like ground or sidewalk that looks completely indistinguishable to every other bit of ground or sidewalk, but clearly has something that is like deeply enthralling to them. And you know, I think there's a few ways you could react to that. You could sort of go, oh, for God's sake, you know, we need to go on a walk and like yank them away. But I think if you really start to consider what they're doing, like it does show you that there's that even parts of the world that are familiar and boring and mundane to us are actually rich with information, are, you know, sort of wondrous and extraordinary through the senses of other animals. And that's like, that's a feeling that I've tried to capture in this book throughout, that paying attention to how other animals sense the world reveals the world that we know in a completely different light. It shows you like flickers of the magical in the mundane.
Yeah, it does really feel like there's this whole secret world that we are not really aware of until we actually pay attention to animals. There are always jokes about a cat or something be able to see ghosts or having extra senses, but it is, I mean, maybe not the ghosts part, but the extra senses, or at least the same senses but used differently, are very true. And, you know, I think it's when we move beyond just like domesticated animals, it's so interesting how their world, even for these like extremely intelligent animals like elephants, can just be, have this whole hidden aspect to it that humans don't necessarily understand until we actually study them. I really loved that example you had in your book. It was the studies of Dr. Lucy Bates, who found elephants expressing confusion over a kind of magic trick Lucy Bates and her right. team did, where they made it see, they made an elephant teleport.
Right.
But only for these elephants. Do you want to describe that study a little bit?
Yes. Yeah, so elephants, like dogs, have this very powerful sense of smell. They obviously have that trunk. They're constantly exploring with it. And so Lucy Bates did this experiment where she followed like a herd of elephants, waited for one of them to pee, and then like waited for them to leave, and then scooped up the urine-soaked soil and put it in a piece of Tupperware, and then drove round to find like either the same herd of elephants or a different herd, like cut them off, dumped out the pea-soaked soil in front of them, and then waited. And what happened was, if she did that for a completely different herd of elephants that was unrelated, they would like examine the soil and then be like, fine, and move on. If it was the same herd, they would examine the soil and be like more interested. It's like, you know, they recognize that it's a family member. But specifically, if it was the same herd and they knew the elephant who left that scent was behind them, they acted very confused because they have an awareness of of their own family members, who's around them, and that awareness is cemented through scent. So if they can smell, if they know that, you know, like Elephant Joe is like way behind in the herd, and suddenly they smell Elephant Joe ahead of them, they're like, wait, what? What? How? Right, and so I love that for several reasons, right? So firstly, it shows that principle we talked about, that like this random bit of soil contains rich information to an animal that can that has the right nose for it, and it's rich biographical information too, right? It's information about who is around and where they are, and also that there's a lovely interaction here between the senses and the intelligence of the animal, right? So the sense. Some animals have all kinds of extraordinary ways of perceiving the world, but when you tack that on to like long-lasting memories or just, you know, advanced cognition, you get these wonderful little interplays, like what these elephants did, being confused by a magic trick that humans have performed.
I also love that we probably wouldn't know about this awareness that these elephants have. It's a very advanced form of cognition to recognize an individual and know where that individual is spatially, and also be able to reason out that, okay, if they're behind us, how could they have jumped ahead in time and gotten ahead of us? That doesn't make sense. So it shows that very complex, rich intelligence. But if we hadn't thought, or at least if Dr. Lucy Bates and her team hadn't thought to investigate their sense of smell, something that to us is not as important in recognizing individuals or understanding sort of time or spatial reasoning, we wouldn't have discovered this aspect of elephant intelligence. So being able to understand the, you know, not look at an animal's intelligence through our human kind of framework, but through the animal's framework, I think would reveal a lot more to us about how intelligent they are.
Totally. And I think this also reveals something important about the scientific method, which is that it is profoundly influenced by the kinds of people who get to be part of science. Like, we sort of think of the scientific method as this like neutral, objective thing. But it's not. It's profoundly influenced by the types of people who are involved in science, and in this case, their own senses. So you're right. Most humans rely on vision above all other senses, and we sort of put that, we map that onto the creatures we study. So with like in animal intelligence, there is this famous test called the mirror test, where you're trying to see if an animal can recognize its a mark that has been placed on its body in its reflection. And this has been, you know, used as a way, this has been linked to everything from all sorts of things like self-awareness, empathy, and so on. But like, it only really applies, it only really works if the animal is visually oriented. And like, people have tried this kind of test with elephants with mixed success. And maybe the reason is that vision just ain't that important for elephants. Like, you know, maybe if you try a version that is specifically related to smell, they do better. And so, you know, this kind of work has been done with dogs for the same reason. They do better at like smell oriented tests of self recognition than visual ones. So, you know, the humans have this very visual bias that affects how they think about the animals that they study and the kinds of research questions that they ask. And it takes a little feat of imagination to actually think like, no, what are the animals themselves sensing, and how do we study that? And how do we craft experiments and studies that really pay respect to their different senses, rather than just, you know, shoving the round peg of animal behavior into the square hole of like of the human umwelt.
Yeah, I can imagine an alien species picking one of us up and maybe changing our smell, like changing our personal smell, which as humans, we don't notice that much. We do to a certain extent, but not much. And then not seeing that we don't notice that change to our own smell and coming to the conclusion, oh, humans aren't self-aware. They have no awareness of self.
Right. Right. Yeah, right, right. Like, we talked about how dogs have, are aware of things on the street that we aren't aware of. But it works in other ways too. Like every animal has its own little sensory bubble. Like we are aware of stimuli in the world that other animals are not, and vice versa. So you're right. There's a very simple example I give in the book where our color vision extends from red to violet, and we can't see ultraviolet light that lies beyond the violet end of the visible spectrum. And for that reason, there's been a lot of mystique around ultraviolet. A lot of scientists have said that it's a secret communication channel that animals use to share messages that no one else can see. But that breaks down when you realize that actually most animals that can see color see ultraviolet. Mm-hmm. We are just the exception. So it's not really super special. It just happens to be another color, and it happens to be another color that we can't see. And if you for a moment you imagine that like bees were scientists, like bees, for a bee, the rainbow goes from green to ultraviolet, so they can't see red. And you can imagine a bee scientist thinking like, oh, these weird two-legged apes, they can see, I guess they would call it like ultra yellow, right? Like the color that they can't see. And maybe it's like really special. Maybe ultra yellow is a way of for them to like exchange secret messages that we can't see. And only after like decades of study would they realize actually a lot of animals can see ultra yellow. There's a lot of, there's a lot of ultra yellow in the world, and it's just another color. I think there's a lot of that around, where there are parts of the world that we don't experience and we think are like just kind of magical. And they're a little magical, but like they're only magical because they're things that we don't have access to.
Become a part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry with an education from Trinity School of Natural Health. Trinity graduates can empower their communities through natural health principles and techniques, whether they go into practice to guide others toward their wellness goals or open a store to sell their favorite health products. Trinity grads are equipped to change lives. With 19 online programs and flexibility to fit your busy schedule, including the popular Certified Natural Health Professional, you can get the training that helps you turn your passion into a career. And here's the best part. You can earn the certification in less than a year. From herbology to naturopathy and health coaching, Trinity allows you to make a meaningful difference by helping others live healthier, happier lives. Don't wait any longer to pursue your passion for natural health. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day. Whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade, at The Home Depot, you can give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to
bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with the Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings Event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out the Home Depot's extensive selection online at HomeDepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See HomeDepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
So there's that a sensory experience you talk about in the book called magnetoreception, that being able to detect the Earth's gravitational field. I'm really jealous of that ability because I get very easily lost. I even with a map like 2 inches from my face, I can get lost. So I would love to have an internal compass like that. And I think, you know, originally it was thought maybe only, you know, a few species had this, but it seems like the more we study it, the more it seems like a lot of animals have this ability. And it seems so magical to us, but it seems not that uncommon.
Yeah, there's a lot of animals that can sense the Earth's magnetic field. So songbirds definitely can do it. A lot of species are known to do it, and they use that ability to guide their migrations. Sea turtles can do it. There's some really interesting work suggesting that giant whales can do it. So magnetoreception, the ability to sense Earth's magnetic field, it's actually a very interesting and quite difficult case study, because there's a lot of work here and some of it might be wrong. There's a lot of debate about which animals actually have this ability. Like the ones I told you, sea turtles and songbirds, I think are pretty clear. Those are pretty definitive. But there's a long list of other creatures that are said to have magnetoreception, and there's just a bit of debate in the scientific community. And partly that debate exists because this is an incredibly hard sense to study. Like, firstly, we don't have it. And also, it's very unintuitive. You know, if you asked me to explain to you how magnetism works, like I would struggle, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I can show you, I can draw you like a textbook picture of a bar magnet with like lines coming out of it, but to actually understand it on a fundamental level, it is hard. And to appreciate then how that might feel to an animal, like there's this idea that songbirds can actually see the magnetic field, that they might have like an overlay on their vision that sort of tells them where like north might be. And, you know, that might be true, but it might not. Like, you know, in either case, it's quite difficult to think about how that feels to an animal. Like, does a migrating turtle always have a little like tug towards like where north is? Does it feel very differently? It for something like that, which is entirely different, a sense that we don't have. It's not like, you know, trying to imagine a bee seeing ultraviolet. It really taxes the boundaries of our understanding, as does the rest of the sense. You know, no one actually knows, like, for vision, right? My vision is in my eyes. The organ is clear. The molecules responsible for my ability to see are known, and the way they work is clear. None of that is clear for magnetoreception. Mm-hmm. Right? There are loads of theories, but the magnetic field penetrates our bodies. So a sense organ doesn't have to be on the surface. It doesn't have to have like a hole that allows it to access an environment. It could be anywhere. It could be distributed throughout my entire body. It could be hidden in my internal organs. It could be in my butt. Who knows? All these possibilities are on the table, which makes it a fiendishly difficult sense to study. And so this goes back to what we talked about the link between imagination and discovery. The fact that this sense taxes our imagination so means that the process of discovery has been very slow and kind of jerky and erratic. And for that reason, I think kind of fun.
Yeah, no, I think it's, in a way, it's comforting to me that we don't know things about the animal world, because it really shows how rich it is. If we already had discovered everything was a settled science, that would be, I think, it would feel lonely because I think there's always this hope that we'll discover more things to make us feel like we're not the only thinking, feeling species on Earth. And so I love it when there are these secrets, because to me it feels like, oh, that this is another thing to try to understand. And, you know, having that understanding of animals around us, you know, it makes me feel like, hey, we're not the only thing around here. We have a bunch of interesting creatures that have their own internal experience, and we can actually try to understand that.
Right. And the wonderful thing here is that every creature has its own unique sensory world. So the amount of stuff that you could potentially learn is almost limitless, right? It's limited only by the number of species that exist. And wherever scientists look, it seems that they always find something cool. And because sensory biology is such an old, rich field with a deep history to it, and because surprises seem to be just around the corner and infinite in their number, there's a lot of work on, frankly, like weird animals. You know, it's not like everything is just in like fruit flies or dogs, mm-hmm. Or elephants. Like, the book also includes catfish and like golden moles, mm-hmm. And you know, there are probably, I would hope, there are animals here that like people have never heard of before, and there's such a rich vein of literature to draw from. There was such a rich vein to draw from in writing this book, because the questions are so fascinating, and like the people who study this, who work in this field, seem to get like very easily drawn towards like weirdos, you know, to some random animal that they happen to like walk past it in a zoo, or you know, stumble across at a field trip, and they suddenly become enraptured by like what, by thinking about how that animal perceives. And yeah, I think there's it means that the book gets to be diverse, and that I get to write about a lot of strange and wonderful things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is the stranger the animal, maybe it gets harder to empathize with it, but the more fascinating it can be. So for example, in the book you discuss a scallop TV study, yeah, where Professor Daniel Spicer put scallops in little scallop chairs and made them watch, yeah, TV. I love this study so much. I love to visualize a bunch of scallops in like a theater watching a movie. And what I love about it also is that it highlights the eyes of scallops. I think people can be quite surprised that scallops have eyes. In yeah, fact, they can have over 100 eyes, and that they're beautiful to me. They're like these little jewels, these shiny little, yeah, bright, bright blue jewels. And I love just finding a hidden secret where, you know, we're used to scallops, like you say in the book, is just kind of this tasty little cylinder of flesh on a plate, but it's an animal and it has this sensory experience. And this scallop TV study is really weird, but really interesting. Could you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, I love the study because everyone involved is very clear that this was an absolutely absurd experiment to try, and no one thought that it would work, but they gave it a go, and they found something really cool, which is that if you put scallops like on these little, I don't know, scallop armchairs and show them movies, like just little flecks of food, like little particles drifting by on a screen, they will react. They'll open their shells, they'll extend their little sensory tentacles in a kind of curious way. And okay, so to explain what this means, as we said, a scallop is a living animal. It is not just like a lump of flesh. The flesh is like the muscle of the scallop's foot, but there's a whole other animal besides that inside the shell, and that includes eyes. It has rows of very beautiful, quite surprisingly complex eyes. And this experiment, the scientists who did it, It's thought that maybe the eyes are used to spot passing food. Scallops will filter bits of food floating past them, so maybe the eyes detect that and allow the scallop to om nom nom. But what they actually think is that now is that the scallops have these like sensory tentacles that smell and taste and feel, and the eyes are just a way of saying, hey, there's something interesting over there, and the tentacles allow them to then explore with their other senses, which is sort of really cool. But I think like the thing that's extraordinary to me about this is try and think about what a scallop sees, because the eyes are, like I said, they're surprisingly complicated. Like they have reasonable optics. So each eye has like, nowhere near as good a vision as us, but they have decent image forming abilities. But the scallop's brain is really simple. Like the scallop is almost certainly not experiencing like a movie playing through its head in the same way that you and I are now like looking up the world around us. So the way I imagine this in the book, it's as if imagine that every eye is like a state-of-the-art motion sensing camera. The camera is amazing, and they all feed into this bank of monitors, and the scallop's brain is like a security guard looking over this bank of monitors that gets the feed from the cameras. But here's the thing. Even though each camera is actually very good, what it gives to the monitor is just like a yes or no. Did it see something or not? So the security guard isn't looking at this like wall of moving images. It's just really looking at this wall of like maybe a thumbs up or a thumbs down, depending on whether the camera has spotted something. So it's vision, but it's vision without scenes. And that's very hard to imagine, because our visual experience is entirely based on scenes, right? Like I'm looking around a room in my house right now. Now imagine if you didn't have that.
Yeah.
Imagine if you could see stuff happening around you. You were visually aware of it, but you didn't have that scenery playing out in your mind. I can't. Like, I really struggle to do that. But that, I think, is a much closer approximation of what a scallop experiences.
You know, this immediately reminded me of blind sight in cortically blind individuals. So that's mm-hmm. people who have blindness due to lesions in their visual cortex, but their eyes, their eyes and their that sensory organ is completely intact and functioning fine. It's just the in the visual cortex where we process that visual information is damaged. And so people with this will report not having that visual experience, just as if they had regular blindness. But when they do have a visual stimuli, they often will react subconsciously, even though they're not experiencing seeing that thing. So especially with object movement. So like they may react to a moving object, but not actually report being aware of that. So like they get a sense, a feeling about, movement, but they don't actually have that conscious experience, which is so interesting. And I think this is also kind of like what you were saying earlier, how respecting sort of the diversity of human experience in science can be really important in understanding the world around us, because I imagine that people with this experience may have more insight into that, having that kind of like not having the visual experience that a lot of people have, but still have their eyes still reacting to the world around them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a, that comparison is spot on. And it makes me think two things. Like, firstly, that there is this, there can be this very stark difference between sensing and perception on the one hand, and then conscious experience on the other, and we sort of I think we're given to thinking that those two things are inseparable, but of course they're not. And Blindside is an example of that. So when we think about, for example, a songbird sensing the Earth's magnetic field, it could work in the same way. Like maybe it actually has no conscious awareness at all. It just has this sort of reflexive set of behaviors that guide it to where it knows north or south might be. There's a lot about the senses that could basically just be about detection without necessarily involving a conscious experience. Like there's a whole chapter in the book about pain and how we think about that draws heavily on that idea. But what you said about Blindside also made me think about the chapter in the book where I write about echolocation, mm-hmm. An ability that bats and dolphins have and some other mammals, and including humans, right? So some blind people can absolutely echolocate, like not as well as a bat, but pretty damn well. I met one of them. His name is Daniel Kish.
Oh, yeah.
He was blind from an extremely young age, and he walks around with a cane, but he also echolocates. He makes loud, sharp clicking noises with his tongue, and he senses the world in the rebounding echoes. You know, we were walking along a street. He knows when a tree branch is in his way. He can tell me as we're walking along, like where houses are, where parked cars are, where bushes and fences are. And it's amazing because I think, like, you know, Daniel points out that there are even echolocation researchers who don't know that humans can do this, but they very much can.
Yeah.
And I think this again speaks to why this stuff is difficult to think about and to imagine, because like a dog or a songbird or an elephant, like none of these animals have language, right? They can't tell me about their experience, but Daniel obviously can. You know, he can describe what he senses, how he experiences the world through echolocation. But even so, there is an enormous barrier there because he doesn't have any memory of being sighted. I don't know what it's like to echolocate. So even though we have the same language, we're still trying to convey things that neither of us are really privy to. And because he grew up in a world with several billion sighted people, a lot of his language is visual. You know, he uses visual metaphors when describing the way he echolocates in a way that, like, I can kind of tap into. But, you know, if he's describing something as like a bright or a flash, like, who knows whether the two of us are using the same words to really convey the same kinds of qualities. And, you know, this is what I said at the start. There's always a gulf. There's always a chasm between our sensory experience and that of another animal, or in this case, another human who just happens to be sensorially diverse. And that's why, you know, these acts of imagination and sort of being thoughtful about how you conceive of other senses is so important.
Yeah, I think sometimes people separate empathy and trying to understand other people from science. Like there's hard science and then there's emotion, you know, like emotional intelligence and scientific intelligence. And I really think that does such a disservice to science, because having that emotional intelligence where you really want to understand another person, I think is such a key to be able to do good science. Because how do you come up with a good study that investigates something that needs to be investigated without being able to connect to other people and their different experience and learn from that?
I 100% agree. I think the people who think that, what you said, the people who think that science is cold and detached and unemotional, honestly, are just terrible scientists. right? Like, I don't trust the quality of their work because, like we said, our, in this case, our senses, but more broadly, like our experience, our culture, our values, profoundly influence the kinds of questions that we ask, the way we design experiments to probe those questions, the way we interpret the returning results. And if you think that that whole process exists in a social and emotional vacuum, then you will be completely oblivious to the biases that you bring into it. And so, which is why I don't trust the work of people who think in that way, you know, because I think that there's a certain thoughtlessness there that leads to misleading research. I mean, even in the field of animal sciences, there have been so many cases. I mean, there's tons in the book where people drew the wrong conclusions about what animals were doing for decades or even centuries because they just weren't paying attention, because they were scoffing at the idea of animals doing something vastly different. Many weird senses, like echolocation, the electric senses of electric fish, magnetoreception, the infrared senses of rattlesnakes and many other animals, have all been subject to this. You know, there's long histories of people thinking that the animals were doing all kinds of weird stuff aside from what they were actually doing, because their existing understanding of the world and the limitations of their own sense organs, like, cut off the possibility of thinking about the much weirder, very different reality.
Well, that's where the concept of blind as a bat came from. People would see bats kind of flitting about erratically as if they didn't know where they were going. But in fact, they are, that erratic movement is actually quite calculated to hone in on an insect as they're using their echolocation. And they're also, as you point out in the book, they are not blind either. And even in the traditional sense, they can use their eyes, but their echolocation skills are the most useful in hunting insects. But yeah, we had this misconception about bats being blind for so long just by misinterpreting their movement, the way that they move in the sky, and assuming that taking a straight path from point A to point B is the correct way to hunt something or to move around.
Right. You know, people scoffed at the idea of echolocation when it was first proposed. You know, there are great stories of, like, you know, so like Robert Galambos, one of the co-discoverers, being, you know, having a guy shaking his shoulders at a meeting going, you can't possibly mean that. You know, So Donald Griffin, the other person who pioneered the study of echolocation, wrote about this idea of echolocation as a magic well, a thing that just yielded one, kept on yielding like one discovery after another. But he also wrote about how scientists were often limited by the scope of their own imaginations, and sort of, you know, just didn't even countenance the possibility that something weird and beyond what they could imagine was actually going on. And it's sort of ironic because, like, Griffin himself was very skeptical about the existence of magnetoreception as a sense, right? So we're all kind of subject to this. So in terms of the blind as a bat metaphor, I think part of that also is related to ableism. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we think of, like, the kind of average default human sensorium as the norm, and anything that sort of deviates from that as being worse. So blind as a bat is derogatory, not really just to bats, but also to blind people.
Yeah.
You know, there's this assumption that, like, sight is good and a lack of sight is bad. You know, we talk about darkness as being a bad thing. You know, we equate blindness with obliviousness, with ignorance. But of course, you know, blind people are profoundly aware of their surroundings. You know, they have abilities and awarenesses that sighted people don't possess, and sort of can't really, and often don't think about or underappreciate. And the same goes for many other animals that have de-emphasized vision in favor of other senses. There's a lot at play here. There's an anthropocentrism, there's ableism, there's a lot that goes into some of these negative and frankly wrong stereotypes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that assumption that you cannot have a rich inner world unless you have the senses, like the kind of assumed senses and the assumed state that a human should be in, right? Like, okay, we all need to be a certain way. We can't have any kind of cognitive differences or sensory differences. Otherwise, you must have a more impoverished inner world is, of course, very wrong. And I think we are, as a society, kind of starting to reckon with that, this idea that, you know, having a different perspective, having different cognition, having different sensory experiences is not something that robs you of, you know, that richness of being. It's just, it is a different experience. You know, it's not, we don't have to have carbon copy experiences and as you say, like the Umwelt, as everyone else. In fact, having people who have different perspectives, different sensory experiences, different cognitive experiences can be very enriching.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's this, I think there's this kind of very deep-seated idea that, like, more is better when it comes to the senses. And so colorblindness is a great example of this, right? There are loads of people who see a small, narrower range of colors than the average person. But, you know, that's no different than the vast majority of other animals, especially mammals, right? So most mammals are dichromatic, which means they have two types of color sensing cells in their eyes, as opposed to three that we have. So my dog, Pipo, is dichromatic. His rainbow extends from yellow to blue, with like whites and grays in the middle instead of greens. And that's what a lot of colorblind people have. And it's fine. Like, yeah. there's it's not the case that, like, having three kinds of color sensing cells is inherently better than two. And in fact, we know that's not the case, firstly, because so many mammals have only two. But also, like, there are many species of monkey in South America. So the females either are trichromatic or dichromatic, but all the males are dichromatic.
Wow.
So there's variation in what kinds of colors even like a brother and a sister monkey can see. The trichromatic females are much better at spotting fruit from a distance, but the dichromatic males are much better at breaking the camouflage of hidden insects. So there's like, there's pros and cons of each, and it's definitely not the case that more is better. So if you think about like colorblind people, like there are things that people with colorblindness find difficult. You know, a lot of tasks that involve colors, like, I don't know, you know, looking at paint swatches or sometimes electrical wiring, traffic lights can be confusing. But like, none of that has to be the case.
Yeah.
Like, colorblindness only becomes a disability because we've created a world that caters for the vision of trichromatic people. You know, there's nothing inherently worse about being a dichromat versus a trichromat. It's just what we choose to value and accommodate to. In many, many ways, I think this book is a call for empathy. It's a call for trying to understand the experiences of other creatures, but also other people too.
Become a part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry with an education from Trinity School of Natural Health. Trinity graduates can empower their communities through natural health principles and techniques, whether they go into practice to guide others toward their wellness goals or open a store to sell their favorite health products. Trinity grads are equipped to change lives. With 19 online programs and flexibility to fit your busy schedule, including the popular Certified Natural Health Professional, you can get the training that helps you turn your passion into a career. And here's the best part. You can earn the certification in less than a year. From herbology to naturopathy and health coaching, Trinity allows you to make a meaningful difference by helping others live healthier, happier lives. Don't wait any longer to pursue your passion for natural health. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day. Whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade, at The Home Depot, you can give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with The Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings Event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97, for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out The Home Depot's extensive selection online at homedepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See homedepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
You know, I had this question because, and this relates a little bit to also your coverage of COVID-19, is that sometimes when people find out that, oh, you know, COVID-19 may have had an animal origin, like, well, doesn't that mean we should cull this animal? Like, shouldn't we avoid researching them? Or, you know, get rid of them? Like, is it so bad if a species goes extinct if we get rid of the threat of COVID or something? And of course, I think there are several things wrong with this, one being like the idea that you could get rid of one species and eliminate all animal reservoirs of a disease. And also this, the jumping to the idea of destruction, you know, destroying something in the name of some kind of imagined safety, rather than trying instead to actually understand more, how is the relationship between humans and animals leading to health crises, both in humans and in animals, and what we can do to prevent that. So, you know, you are someone who is both very well-versed in these zoonotic diseases, as well as, you know, the basically that we should respect animals and respect their rights to be here. So what would you say to someone who feels that way, that like we should either be afraid of these animals or get rid of them when they are in our, territory, or what we perceive to be our territory?
Right. I think it's a profoundly misguided idea. I mean, I can see why people think that. So SARS-CoV-2 almost certainly came from a bat, and bats in general harbor a lot of viruses that could potentially cause problems for humans. But, you know, a couple of things. Firstly, bats are incredibly important, and they play, you know, vital, irreplaceable roles in most of the ecosystems where they live. So you just can't get rid of bats. Secondly, there are a lot of bats. It's like, you know, bats are like a fifth of all mammal species, and they're incredible creatures in their own right. Like, the specific group that is, you know, that SARS-like viruses are often found in have this incredible style of echolocation that is even like weirder and more advanced and more sophisticated than what like your average bat can do, which is already pretty spectacular. So there's that. There's what we stand to lose. But then there's also the fact that this idea assigns blame to entirely the wrong party. Mm-hmm. Like, why are zoonotic events, why are zoonotic spillovers becoming more common? They're becoming more common because we have destroyed habitat, because we have encroached into the spaces where animals, wild animals live, and because we have crushed those animals into smaller and smaller ranges. You know, it's like I said in one of my pandemic pieces, you know, it's as if we've been crushing the world's wildlife in an ever-tightening fist. And what happens is that viruses start bursting out of that. But, you know, there's also the fact that we are reshuffling the networks of mammals and their viruses all around the world. As the world warms because of climate change, species of mammals that mammals are having to move in order to track new areas that have the environments that they were well adapted to. As this happens, species that never previously coexisted are meeting each other for the first time, which creates opportunities for their viruses to hop into new hosts and then eventually into us. This has been happening for decades now, and we're sort of in the peak of that process as we speak, which means that the kinds of events that led to a new coronavirus ripping through the human population are becoming more and more common. And they're becoming more and more common because of things that we did, because of changes that we wrought upon the world. And if we don't fix those changes, you know, you're not going to be able to drive the risk of pandemics down to zero by culling bats. If anything, you're just going to make the ecosystems where those bats live much worse, and you're going to lose the whatever spectacular way of experiencing the world those bats have. That, you know, we look for the problem in the wrong place, in that we try and shove responsibility onto others, and we try and look for quick, easy, sticking plaster fixes. The problem lies within us, and the fixes need to be much bigger and much more systemic. So I think, yeah, unless we actually extend the full force of our empathy and ingenuity to the rest of the natural world and understand that we are a part of it and that we have had a profound influence in shaping it, then, you know, we're just going to experience more of these problems. Like that climate change phenomenon, the link between climate change and pandemic risk, what that tells us, what that should tell us, is that many of the big existential problems of our time, climate change, the sixth extinction, mass extinction of wildlife, the risk of future pandemics, they're all the same problem. They're all facets of the same interconnected mega problem. And the responsibility for fixing that problem is on us, not on bats.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think is very evident in your book, this idea that our human experience is the only important thing is just very wrong. But in addition to that, I think it's important to remember that our sort of priorities and the priorities of, you know, our ecosystem are not necessarily in conflict. We can actually have a lot of solutions to our own human issues, our own problems, by turning to our animal cousins and trying to both help them and also understand them.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And in the last chapter of my book, I talk about this problem of sensory pollution, this idea that we have flooded the dark with light and the quiet with noise in ways that really harm the creatures around us and that we sort of don't really understand or appreciate. I mean, light has positive connotations with us, and darkness has negative ones. You know, we crave more illumination, not less. But the amount of light pollution in the world is phenomenal and causes a lot of harm to insects, to birds, to sea turtles, to all kinds of creatures. And, you know, it hurts us too in ways that I think we don't really appreciate. Like, so many people have never really seen the night sky, have never really seen what the stars look like. Certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, have never seen, like, have you ever seen the Milky Way?
I only saw it when I went to the Sequoias and got really far away from the city. And it was, I was so shocked that it existed. When I was imagining the Milky Way, I just imagined maybe a few more stars. I had no idea how vast and bright it was, and that mm-hmm. would get drowned out by city lights. You know, even, you know, when I was a kid living in the suburbs, thinking like, well, it's not that bright out. Why wouldn't I be able to see it? It is shocking what you are missing in the night sky.
It's really shocking. And like, that sight is just like transcendentally beautiful. Like, I think the first time you see it, because most of us have never seen it before, it's just like achingly beautiful to behold. But, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to see it. Like, it's clearly visible in the Northern Hemisphere. It's just that the light from all of these distant stars from our own galaxy travels, you know, countless light years, reaches Earth, and then gets washed out by the glow of our own buildings. And I think that's profoundly sad. You know, we affect our own health, our own biological clocks by the lights we produce at night. And I think that the thing about sensory pollution that's really important is that, unlike a lot of the other things that we're doing to the world, you know, unlike greenhouse gas emissions, unlike plastic pollution, environmental toxins, this is easy to fix. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, light pollution goes away when you turn the lights off. It is literally a switch. We just have to care enough to want to fix the problem.
Yeah, and I think there are other types of sort of sensory pollution that we're just like learning about, like the idea that animals that have a wider range of visual perception than we do can see sort of a halo coming off of power lines, and mm-hmm. that to them it's this intimidating, glowing thing, not, you know, where to us, you know, we may only kind of perceive a slight buzzing coming from it. Or like with birds, like whose mating cycles are entirely dependent on them being able to hear each other. That's like the way that they can locate each other for mating, and how that so negatively impacts their breeding cycles when there's too much noise pollution. If we don't even really understand what their sensory world is, how can we have the empathy to know even what to change? And I think, for me, that is what is so important about books like yours and learning about these animal internal experience, because it is so vital in understanding our world and how to, you know, basically prevent our world from becoming dull and, you know, bereft of this diversity of experience.
Yeah. And, you know, we can choose something different. Like at the start of the COVID pandemic, when a lot of people were, you know, staying at home, there was a lot of talk of, there were a lot of cases of people going, are there just more birds? right? Like, loads of people said that. And it's not that there were just more birds. It's just that you can hear them now because everyone's being a lot quieter. And what happens when you're quiet is not just that you start picking up on sounds that might otherwise be drowned out, but you can hear over much longer distances. You know, even just a few decibels less noise, you know, can double the radius over which you're hearing. And so sensory pollution is the pollution of disconnection. It disconnects us from the sounds of nature around us by shrinking our own sensory bubble. It disconnects us from the cosmos by drowning out the lights of distant stars. And, you know, it's sort of ironic that at this moment, in that moment in time when people felt isolated, in some ways, they actually were more connected to the world around them. And I think, like, you know, we should aim for that. I mean, not like the horrible, like, not, I'm not saying we should aim for like lockdowns and stay at home orders. We should aim for being more connected through the world around us by expanding the reach of our own senses, and by going on these, you know, mental adventures and thinking about the senses of other animals.
Yeah, I mean, circling back to what we talked about with dogs' perception, I enjoy my walks with Cookie a lot more after reading the book and really thinking about how much fun she's having smelling these things. And I just watch her and enjoy seeing her reaction to things, or like I'll hide little treats around the house and watch her like sniff. I see she catches the scent and she tries to find it. And it's, you know, in that very simple, limited way, it's brought me so much more joy. And I think that if we extend that past just the cute animals like dogs into, you know, all sorts of animals out there, even the maybe less beautiful ones like snakes and spiders, bats, although personally I think bats are very, very cute, you know, really kind of feeling that excitement about watching them experience the world and understanding, hey, they have that internal experience. It's like when you're a really young kid and you finally come to the realization, oh, wait, there are a ton of people on Earth and they each have their own internal experience, and that immensity of understanding, hey, like I am not the only conscious human and there's so many other conscious humans. And then like extending that realization to animals, I think is a very profound and enriching experience.
Yeah, me too. I couldn't agree more.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for joining me today. This was wonderful. I love your book. I am eternally grateful for your articles as well, because without them, this podcast would probably be a lot less interesting. So where and when can people get a copy of your book?
So An Immense World is out on June 21st in all the places you get books from, preferably your local bookstore, but anywhere you want to grab a copy, please do. You can get the audiobook as well, which is read by me. It should be out pretty soon. I hope you all check it out, and I hope everyone enjoys it. I hope it brings a bit of joy to people's lives at a moment when I think we could all use more infusions of joy.
Well, I can attest to that. I really enjoyed it. Before we go, let's play Guess Who's Squawking, the Mystery Animal Sound Game. Every week I play a mystery animal sound, and you, the listener, guess who is making that sound? It can be any animal on Earth. So the hint for last week's mystery animal sound was this. Though featured in The Silence of the Lambs, this fellow is not so silent. So congratulations to Joey P., Keegan H., and Remy H., who were the fastest guessers for the Death's Head Moth. So the Death's Head Moth was featured on the poster for Silence of the Lambs. They have what appears to be a human skull marking their thorax. So to make that chirping sound, they actually inhale and exhale air, forcing it through their mouth tube, which was thought to originally be used to like slurp up sugary syrup, but it is now used to make sound, and it can vibrate like an accordion. And this is a way of scaring away predators, so startling them and hopefully scaring them away. And due to the skull-like marking and shrill squeaks, it has become a figure in many superstitions. So, on to this week's mystery animal sound. Here's your hint. It has a prehensile tail, a hunger for eucalyptus, and for fresh meat. If you think you know who's squawking, you can write to me at creaturefeaturepod@gmail.com. Also on Twitter at creaturefeetpod. That's F-E-A-T, not F-E-E-T. That is something very different. And if you leave a rating or review, I would be ever so grateful. I read all the reviews and they mean so much to me. And thanks to the Space Cossacks for their super awesome song, Exolumina. Creature Features, a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like the one you just heard, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or hey, guess what? Wherever you listen to your favorite shows, I do not judge you. See you next Wednesday.
Become a part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry with an education from Trinity School of Natural Health. Trinity graduates can empower their communities through natural health principles and techniques, whether they go into practice to guide others toward their wellness goals or open a store to sell their favorite health products. Trinity grads are equipped to change lives.
With 19 online programs and flexibility to fit your busy schedule, including the popular Certified Natural Health Professional, you can get the training that helps you turn your passion into a career. And here's the best part. You can earn the certification in less than a year. From herbology to naturopathy and health coaching, Trinity allows you to make a meaningful difference by helping others live healthier, happier lives. Don't wait any longer to pursue your passion for natural health. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.